Sidewalk Stories is a silent film shot in black and white on the streets of New York in 1989. It was written, directed, and stars Charles Lane, who drew inspiration from the silent comedy greats like Chaplin, Keaton, and Harold Lloyd to make a present-day comedy about homelessness with a mostly African-American cast. Lane plays the artist, an aspiring illustrator down on his luck who spends his days peddling portraits in Greenwich Village. At night, he sleeps in a makeshift apartment in an abandoned tenement. His life dramatically changes in the course of a day when he's forced to take care of a 2-year-old toddler he found on the street. Lane, who originally hated silent movies, says Sidewalk Stories was meant to be an experiment in pure cinema, a type of filmmaking that honors film in its most elemental, original form. He recently screened the film in honor of its 25th anniversary as part of the Film Independent at LACMA screening series, and afterwards joined Elvis Mitchell for the following conversation. This podcast contains explicit language.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I've always thought this is being, as I was saying in the introduction, such a subversive film because it's so much about, in its way, black identity to me mm-hmm. without having to speak about it.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's such a wild thing to do.
Yeah, you know, there was and still is a book called The Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. Yeah, and in the book he speaks about you know the non-verbal or the symbolic invisibility of our culture, and that was something of an inspiration. It kind of justified the silence of the film, along with other things too. But that was in my head about being seen but not heard, kind of thing.
And also, that line from what did I do to be so black and blue, mm-hmm. is also a kind of an underlying thing in this too, isn't it?
Indeed. And the other thing is, like, you know, thematically, one was thinking of that old line, like, you know, we're our brother's keeper, and therefore, by the grace of God, go I.
Because mm-hmm. I guess I just thought, too, did you know, I mean, how subversive a piece of material this was to do at the time?
I had an idea that there were many things going through my head at the time. I had an idea that it was a little different, you know. But also the fact that it was a silent film, the fact that it was a feature film. In college, in 1976, I had made an experimental short movie that was silent. The reason I did it was because I hated silent movies, by and large. I hated them. And it's
true. Wait a second. You hated silent movies.
I did. I'm not exaggerating here. I really had no time for them because they represented to me a kind of archaic, you know, insignificant way of existing cinematically because, you know, there used to be the kerosene lamp, you know, and now we have the electric light. And so we don't necessarily embrace the kerosene days, you know what I mean? So for me, silent films were like the kerosene horse and buggy thing, you know? You know, it's to be like acknowledged, but not necessarily embraced. I was more in college about technology, color, sound, special effects, and like that. And I decided one day not to be such a snob. After all, I was in school to learn. And I kind of thought that I knew a lot, and I decided to make a film, do something as an exercise that I really have resentment towards, try to do it well, and it's a win-win situation. If I did it well, I would become a better visual storyteller, better filmmaker. I always loved Hitchcock, and he often talked about pure cinema and visual stuff, and so I took that to heart. So I decided to study Chaplin and to study Buster Keaton and such like that, and make
and there's a lot of
film.
Harold Lloyd in this too.
There's a lot of Harold Lloyd, although, like, you know, one doesn't compare to Harold Lloyd or Chaplin or Keaton, you know, but you do the best you can. And so that's what I did. And in 1976, and we'll talk about the composer, I'm sure. 1976, we did the short film, and it came out pretty good, and we won a Student Academy Award for it, which was great. And after that, I had grown up a little bit and understood the significance of silent movies.
Is that the point where you discover Chaplin? Did somebody say, hey, you got to go see City Lights, you got to see The Kid? Did somebody drag you to a Chaplin film?
In a way. This is ridiculous, but I'll tell you the story quickly. In 1973, I was taking film theory classes and such, and it was my it was my technique to cut class on Monday nights because they were showing silent movies. And that's, yeah. So I would cut class and hang out with my buddy Joe Robinson, and we'd go to the Rathskeller and get some beers and some white wine or whatever. And he's a political science major, right? So this particular night, you know, on schedule, ready to cut because they were showing the Gold Rush. And he said, "The Gold Rush?" I said, yeah, let's go. He said, "No, wait a minute. That's a funny film." I said, "Okay, whatever, let's go drinking." And he said, no, seriously. You know, there's a scene with Chaplin, and there's the cabin over the cliff. And I said, "Yeah, but who cares? You're a political science major. What are you telling me? Let's go." He said, "No, you really should. We'll cut next week, but you really should see this film." And, you know, I felt embarrassed because he had no right telling me about cinema, right? And, you know, I went, I saw the film, and I was like, whoa. You know, and that's when I first discovered Chaplin, and that was in 1973. But still, even though that impressed me, my point was that I still didn't like silent films. That was a good one, but I didn't like silent films, and it wasn't until 1975 that I started to make that short film where I started to really study and appreciate and learn and grow.
We should also say, too, you were at SUNY Purchase, which is a great theater school, which is where Wesley Snipes was in school, and you were also, you were telling me backstage, you were in school with Edie Falco.
Right, indeed. And I didn't know her personally then, but when we started Sidewalk, which was 1989 that we started, because we did it very quickly, wrote the script.
How long was that whole process to write and everything and shoot?
The whole process, I started in 1988 in November, and by January, I was ready to go. Actually, a little bit before January, I was ready to go. We started casting and getting our people together late January, and we started shooting, I think. Bill, do you remember, was it February 2nd or February 10th that we started shooting?
We had a couple false starts.
Okay, well, you heard it from the man. We had a couple of false
starts. Cinematographer, Bill Dill out there.
Yeah.
So, but you were telling me before we sat down outside that you were told in March, if you got the film finished in time, you could get into the Cannes Film Festival. So you're saying you basically went from shooting in January to having the film ready to play the Cannes Film Festival in
March.
Yeah,
that was a big fantasy. That was a big fantasy. The Cannes, you know, one hears about that when one is a little boy in the cradle, you know. The Cannes Film Festival, it's this thing, you know, this silver chalice. And so here I was with, a silent movie, you know, with no dialogue and all, but there was a possibility of getting into the Cannes Film Festival. That was a big deal. The other thing about March is I was told by more seasoned filmmakers than myself, although we went to the same school and all, but they were working before myself. And I was told that if you shoot in the winter months, if you shoot between like January and March, you can get really good people on your crew because those are the down months. As of March, the people go for the real jobs. And are there any children in the audience? Because no, because I sometimes curse and I don't want to be offensive. But then you're fucked, you know, if you get into March and there are no crew people. Right. So it was incumbent on us to shoot the film quickly. We had 14-day shoot, like a 2-week shoot, and our camera broke at one point, and we lost a day, so it was 15 and a half days to do the film. And we had a small time for editing, and the whole idea was to get it into the Cannes Festival, if such a thing were possible. But not totally experienced like I was. You're told about things to combat other things. So I know we're shooting in the cold weather. I know the frost is going to come out. I know that's not romantic. So how do you fight it? Well, Charlie, you take ice cubes and you put them in your mouth, and then presto magic. So I thought, cool, now I know something. So we tried to do that the first day, and that only got the actors much more cold. You know, they were like that. So and they just said,
so the teeth were chattering.
Yeah, you know, not
the teeth
cold.
Were chattering in a silent movie. That would be the saddest thing of all time.
Exactly. So it was like, you know, screw the ice cubes, and we'll just go with the frost, and maybe some people will miss some of the times. I know that you didn't, but yeah, the frost is coming out. That's happening a lot. So Bill, how did I meet Bill? Someone recommended him because the cameraman, you know, my school buddy said, the first day you go out shooting, the weather will hit them and then they will mutiny. They will abandon the film. And so Bill was recommended. We talked. We really hit it off. He has, Bill, I'm talking about you, man. So, but he had a great cinematic sense and very important to me, an appreciation of the old films, of the old masters. You know, he and I talked about Night of the Hunter, 1955, Charles Laughton, you know, Robert Mitchum, Lillian Gish.
Well, that first shot, it could be a shot of Night of the Hunter, and you're going across that block in the village. I mean, that's a shot of Night of the Hunter.
That's about nearly a five-minute shot. Now, Bill, I'm going to talk about you again. Here's the thing. When we were talking about, you know, what I wanted to do, and Bill had never shot a silent movie. I had only shot a small silent movie. I mean, no one makes silent movies. But Bill was like, yeah, we can do it. And it's going to be called, yeah, we can do it. And I told him about the long shot that I wanted to do. Yeah, we can do it. But, you know, just clean, just not interrupted. Yeah, we can do it. So what happened was, we get out there the first day, and it's really cold, and we have, was it a Western Dolly, Bill? Okay, Western Dolly, right? And here's this elaborate, I have my actors all choreographed because, you know, when you make a film with the title Sidewalk Stories, you know, one on cold days would rather be on the inside where it's nice and charmingly warm, but Sidewalk Stories means you're on the sidewalks, okay? So we were like freezing, the lens was freezing. Bill had this technique of using a hair dryer to warm up the lens and all that stuff. And we were trying to get that shot. We were taking a rehearsal. The actors were choreographed, and we didn't quite make it. And Bill said, you know, Charles, maybe you want to pop in a few shots. Now, he and I had already discussed this. There would be no pop-ins, but he was trying to be reasonable because he understood this shit ain't going to really necessarily work. So he, as graciously as he could, he was trying to make a new suggestion to me. Maybe you should try in a few pop-ins. I said, no, Bill, we really got to do it. And the other thing, too, was, and this was a big risk, wisdom told me that a shot like that, which is like, you know, the biggest, hardest shot in the movie, basically, a shot like that should be done, executed, when your crew and yourself and your actors, when you build some muscle, you know, and you, then you feel like, yeah, we're ready to do that. My approach was to do it the opposite, and I knew it was risky, and I told Bill, and he said, well, if that's what you want to do, okay, I'm with you, because he was always with me. And I said, I want that to be the first shot that we do. And that's backwards. That's ass backwards because no one is really lubricated and in concert necessarily. But I knew that we had a limited amount of time, you know, as the captain of the ship, so to speak. Limited amount of time. I knew what Ron Fortunato, my former camera person, had told me. They will mutiny the first day once that cold hits their ass, you know. So I said, okay, you know what? Let's do the hardest thing first. If we pull it off, which we probably won't, if we pull it off, then those bitches are mine. Basically, then they know they can do anything. Anything. There's nothing too big for them to do if you do that. But it's a risky thing. And Bill was like, okay, if that's what you want to do, kind of thing. So the first time we did it was all fucked up. And he's like, pop-ins. And I said, no, let's go for it. And then we got a good rehearsal all the way from beginning to end. And it was Bill who said to me, and I remember this moment, he said, we can do this. And I said, okay, we can do this, you know. No pop-ins, never a word about that again. And then we did it, we rehearsed it again, maybe a third time, and then we got it, you know, we got the camera. And on the Western Dolly, it's not linear tracks like that. You're crabbing, you're moving in, you're moving out, moving in, moving out, and so on. But once Bill fell in love with the rehearsal from beginning to end and said, we can do this. I said, oh, fuck. I can make this film now because he really saw it, you know. And before, he was, like, trying to protect me. Like, you know, you may want to do some pop-ins, you know. Like, some pop-ins.
Yes, let's not let the crew kill you on our first day of shooting. That's if you right. Just do these pop-ins, yeah. We'll go back to it later.
Later. We'll get that later.
Last day.
Although it's not in the budget. We'll shoot it. Yeah, exactly. So but once he said, we can do this, you know, we were ready to go. And so once we did it, the crew was stronger, and they knew they could do anything. There was nothing. That was the biggest shot. There was nothing too large or too deep that they could not do. And we stayed together. And the other thing I was warned about is catering. Food. If you have really good food, even on a low-budget film, the lower the budget, the better the food better be. And so my sister-in-law at the time had a catering company called Palatable Panther. And we had great food. We had filet mignon. We had stuff like the crew was like happy. Even though they were cold, they were ready to eat. And so that helped us stay together as well.
So you young filmmakers, feed your crew.
Yes.
And everything will fall into place. I guess what I just found, and I was talking to you about this when we were outside, is how great this score is. Mm. And you can, in terms of themes and use of music and the way the music sort of calls into tells you what part of the city you're in and what the mood of the scene is, that's where I really feel like the artist paid tribute to you.
Yeah, cool. That's cool. Yeah, it, again, it was Mark Mortar and myself, the collaboration. And I've been fortunate, you know, with great collaborators from my early days, like Ann Stein, you know, the editor of the film, with myself. You know, I hadn't met her. I didn't know her. She was recommended too, and we hit it off the first day, and she understood what the story was about, and you know, we collaborated. And it wasn't a conflict. We had one thing, and I'm going to talk about it. We had one thing, and that was a simple shot of Lady, the lead actress, coming out of the taxi, and we wanted to match it with a cut. And Anne was like, I don't know if this is going to work. And I said, I think it could work. And we didn't make a money bet, but it was like a kind of side bet. And then it worked and said, Charlie, you're a good man. And I said, no, you're a better woman. And, you know, but we never had a bad word, nor Bill and myself. And Mark Mortar, I met him in 73 briefly, and then in 75. I was working in the film department, you know, handing out equipment and signing equipment out for people. And I heard some music in the next room through the wall, experimental music. I heard voices, I heard percussion, I heard a double bass. And that was going on for a while, and it was time for me to close up. And I went to the next room because I wanted to see who was playing. And it was Mark, and I had met him before 2 years ago on campus. And I said, where are the other musicians? And he said, what are you talking about? I said, no, the people who were here with you. He said, no, that was all me. And I said, what? You know? And he said, yeah. And he showed me it was a piece by, I think, Herman Druckmann. It's, I don't know if that's right, Cecilia, but it's called Valentine. And he was doing that piece, and it involves, you know, pizzicato. It involves, you know, strumming the bass and using your knuckles and the mallet and your voice. And, you know, one of those experimental pieces. And so he played it for me, and that was cool. Now, at that time, I was doing A Place in Time, and I fashioned myself possibly of writing the score, although I don't know how to write music. I know music well. I don't know how to fucking write music. And
there are no children here, right?
Sorry. And I thought maybe some albums, like some Scott Joplin or something, but I wanted an original score. So I asked Mark, would he notate for me? I'll play the piano. I'll pick it up by ear on the piano, and he would score it on paper. And he said, sure, I'll do that. And he could get that for credit. So I wrote this like very below mediocre tune, like a 3-4 time waltz. And he wrote it out for me. And he said, Charles, I'd like you to hear something. I mean, it's nothing, but I'd like you to hear something. And I said, fine. And he played this piece that he had written for like a ballet class or something. Very, very good. Simple, but complex at the same time. And he wrote it like in, you know, I guess 2 minutes. That piece that I'm talking about, it took me about 2 weeks to write that stupid piece of crap that I wrote. So I knew then that I was out of my league, and I said, Mark, how would you like to score this movie for me like that? And he said, I don't know anything about scoring a movie. I said, see, I know everything about it, it's just that I can't do it, but I know how to teach it. And he was like, yeah, I don't know. And I said, no, trust me. So, I exposed him to movie compositions, you know, from earlier films, from silent films to The Godfather, you know, and I was saying, you see, this is like the overall theme of the movie, and this is the leitmotif. This is speaking about the character, so this is the signature. When that character comes on, that's what you hear, and then variations of that. And, you know, speaking language that he knew somewhat, but he was understanding the way, the mechanics of how that score aspect works. And so he scored The Place in Time, and as I said, we won the Student Academy Award. That was great. So when it was time to do Sidewalk Stories, which is like 13 years later, there was only one guy to do my score, and that was Mark Mortar, because by that time, we had shorthand language. I could go, shibba-dubba-dubba, and he would go, what you mean to say is shabba-dubba-dubba, and I'd say, exactly, you know, that kind of thing. And he moved to Paris. He was living there since 1978, I think. I was still in New York. And 1989, Sidewalk Stories, he was the guy to do the score. So we were communicating over the phone. There was no internet. Oh, boy. There was no internet at that time. There was, you know, it's only like a telephone and telephone bills, you know. Like,
oh, my God.
Yeah, so to pass. So, you know, I would hum some things to him, and he would say, I got you. And then the next day or the day after, you know, he would play it back for me on the piano and say, yeah, always better than what I hummed, always better than what I imagined. The tune, the little girl's lullaby tune, which bum bum bee bum 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 bee bum bum, right? He had played that for me. He had composed that because I told him kind of what I wanted it to be, a lullaby, so he put that together. And when the second time that it's repeated, when the little girl is brought into the house, and my character lays her down on the bed, on the floor bed, and all, I said to him, you know, we need something else there, and it's like it may be like a viola or maybe a cello, and that's where Cecilia comes in. It may be a cello, but we need not to just repeat that second part again. And I said, for example, played hum the part for me. Then he hummed the part, da da dee da da da. And then when it repeated the second time, I gave him like a cello, my best cello, over the phone in New York to Paris. I got it. I know what you mean. And so 2 days later, he played it for me, you know, skeletal, and that was it. And that was the part that Cecilia played, you know, which is a beautiful, like, cello piece that accompanies the top line of the piano lullaby.
So that's the one thing people, in writing about this movie over the years, that collaboration between you and Mark doesn't get that credit, because that's really what makes, that's the language of the film as much as the visual storytelling. I mean, that not only, because he also uses music almost in that, like music concrete, like found music, and like found sound rather. So that cello thing you're talking about is both musical, but it's also a really aggressive oral piece to the soundtrack.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing too is that, you know, we understood, you know, one became very afraid, because although I had some fortune with the short film, with A Place in Time in 76, this is a feature film. You know, a short film at 33 minutes, if it's silent, it's like, okay, we appreciate it, nicely done. We don't want to see any more of this stuff, you know, like done. So on a feature level.
So once you get past that kind of novelty of, oh, this is silent, yeah, it's like, yeah. Oh, this is silent.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So for an hour and a half to do it on that level, that's much more tricky. That's much more scary. And so,
Also to do it without titles.
That's true. So that's the other thing, without titles. If I was going to do a silent movie, I wanted to make sure that we did something novel, that we did something not necessarily repeating that which was done on the beaten path.
That makes it modern. It's not a period film, or it's not evoking period film by having titles at all.
Right. And I knew that if we could pull it off, obviously, you know, it would be a grand thing, because then, commercially speaking, in Poland, you wouldn't have to change the intertitles. You wouldn't have to reinterpret it for Japan. You wouldn't have to if it's purely visual cinema, as Hitchcock talked about, then there's nothing to translate. It's just plays, because the music is the universal dialogue, universal language, and so there's nothing to fucking read. You know, there's nothing. It's gone. But that kind of ambition can lead to trouble, because there were like two scenes, don't remember what they were now, where I got into trouble and I said, God damn it, I could use a title here and I could use a title right there. That would explain everything. And then I said, I understood, like, you can't make a film, you can't reach out so ambitiously and like, I'm not using titles. And then, like, you know, three quarters into the movie, oops, there's a title, and then another title. Because what does the audience say? They say, he got into trouble. He didn't know how to get out. That's why he needs a title. So that's blasphemous. So I had to do it the hard way and figure it out, how to do it without the titles. But I needed those two titles in those places. And when I did figure it out, it was good, because the film has no titles, nothing to really read to move the story along. So that felt good too.
That to me is the thing that really made it feel like a modern, like a break with everything that had been done in silent film before with those titles, because that opening sequence, that long tracking shot, is something that goes back to the beginning of films. It goes back to Nosferatu, to Howard Hawks' Scarface, with those long, I mean, people think tracking shots Orson Welles, but they did that stuff in silent films. But they also moved across a kind of trompe l'oeil, where it's something painted on the side, but you were on the real street, and just the idea, you know, of moving that camera through that. That felt to me like it was both modern and harkening back to silent film. But for me, watching the film, it became almost like a kind of tension. When is a subtitle coming up? When is a title card coming up?
Sure.
And I, for the first half hour, I kept thinking about that as I was watching it for the first time. And then when I stopped thinking about it in the movies, I went, wait a second, there was never a title card.
Yeah, that's cool. That's the intent too. And I had heard other people say a variation of what you just said, and also talk about the fact that nobody's talking. What they didn't know was silent going in when they paid their like $11 back in the day. They didn't know was silent. They were pissed the fuck off. Like, what the fuck, man? You know, black and white, and nobody's. You know.
How do you remember with black people when they aren't talking? What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
They're not even talking on the screen, let alone talking to the screen. Right. right.
I have to ask you too. I mean, the question you probably had 1,000 times. Can your daughter stand to be out in the cold now after you tortured her for 2 weeks? And again, they will call Child Protective Services on you nowadays. It would have shut down. You'd be on TMZ. You have to defend yourself. This black man took his child out there in the freezing cold for 2 weeks.
It's
Nancy
true.
Grace would be like taking you down on. It would be just. It would
Yo,
be
Nancy Grace. Yeah, I love Nancy. I love her. I love her because she gets so passionate, doesn't she? You know, with that accent. What kind of moron would take their child? You know, oh, Nancy, Lord Nancy. But the thing is, I don't know. For those of you who may not know, the little girl is my daughter in real life, and the thing. She's 2 years old at the time. The thing, and incidentally, she's not into film as a big appreciative audience. You know, she appreciates film. She's getting her PhD now at Yeshiva University on the East Coast in child psychology. I'm not exaggerating. It's true. It's true.
You've created a monster. Well, maybe she can stop people like you from making films with their children.
I know. It's true. But she's not a big fan. You know, she appreciates that she did it. The whole thing with her was kind of psyching her out, as you know, the old axiom that says you'll never work with children or animals, right? Not to equate the two, but the point is that, you know, you just can't control them. Right. You can't, you know, I'll pay you more. It means nothing to them. A child, I'll up your salary. That means nothing. You know, an animal, like, I'll get you better oats. And it means nothing. So you can't negotiate with them. That's the thing. So you have to become enslaved to them while trying to navigate it. And I understood that very well. So with my daughter, what we did, I got a 16mm camera on a tripod. She was sleeping in the crib at the time, and the tripod and the camera remained in front of her crib for like weeks. And, you know, it was fascinating at first, and then it was boring later. And so the whole idea was that once we got on set, she would see what was boring to her and not give a fuck, because, you know, you cannot look into the lens, although, you know, by design, my character does it twice, but, you know, that's not the thing. And so she was really good that way. The other things, because you can't negotiate with a child, you have to make it a game for them and make it fun. And so that's what it was with Nikki. It was fun and a game. And, you know, because this film was silent, I was able to coach her during some of the
takes. That's actually like a real problem-solving thing to do, to make a silent film with a kid so you can sort of direct her as you're working with her and people can't tell what you're saying.
Correct. And, you know, the whole thing is not to move your lips too much because they can't tell what you're saying, but they can see that you're fucking saying it, you know? So you gotta, you know, you have to do that. But, so for Nikki, it was really cool. She had a few moments. The kidnappers, she was genuinely afraid of those two actors who kidnapped her. Genuinely afraid. And the crying wasn't because she was afraid. It was because in the taxi, when she's saying no, no, and they're trying to coax her to work for them and do those sketches to make money, and she's saying no. The thing with my daughter was, and I don't know that this is so common with a lot of children, but with my daughter, she resented very much, very passionately, the words, it's time to take a nap. That she would rebel against, you know? And like, no, I'm not tired. You know, she wanted to see everything. She wanted to be everywhere. So when it was time for her to take a nap, she would, like, cry. And I used that. So in the cab, I'm at the bottom of the yellow cab, you see, and the actors are acting with her with the pen and the crayons and all, and I'm in the cab saying, Nikki, you have to go take a nap. You have to, no, I don't want to, like that. And so, you know, that's the way we got that effect, and it's very funny, but it's true.
You know, we actually have Child Protective Services here now to take you away for having done that.
Oh, I thought you scared me.
Heartless filmmaker.
You heartless.
Oh, my God.
You scalawag.
That's right. There are laws for people like you, boy. But just to get back to, because I'd asked you earlier, just talk to you about being at SUNY Purchase, which you were there when they were just starting that incredible theater program.
Yeah.
I mean, which was, I mean, so many great actors and film professionals have come out of that.
Stan Tucci?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Ving Rhames went there for a little
bit. Yeah, absolutely. He did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Almost like the entire cast of that TV show Wings came out of SUNY Purchase. Wow. A lot of those guys were there. But that must have been too kind of a place that made you think that you could do this, because you were surrounded by this thing that was new and exciting and people figuring it out. And you were part of that first wave of people at SUNY Purchase.
Yeah, you know, and when, you know, like I guess in many things, when you're younger, you know, there's more fearlessness, less responsibility and such. So, yeah, why not? I'm going to do a silent film. Why not? Why not? When you get older, you become more jaded, you become more laden with responsibility, and like, you know, it's not so much why not, it's like, why? Why would I want to do that? Why would I want to make a silent film? For what do I want to make this film? You know? So, you know, like that.
That's what you do at Yeshiva University. After that.
Exactly. Correct, sir, you are correct.
So anyway, why should I make a silent film? I mean, I have to ask you, what was it like the first time you saw it with an audience? Was the last question. The first time you saw Sidewalk Stories with an audience.
You said the last question? Don't make it the last question. Come on, I'm on a roll now, man. Ask me 21 more questions and then I'll be ready.
I thought this was a pretty good one, Ando. You're going to judge my question asking. Fine. Now we really are done. Okay. But no. Let's say I had a question.
Now we really
what
are done.
What was the very first screening of with an audience like of the film of Sidewalk Stories?
When it was, now I had mentioned before, we had a different score than when
telling the story, yeah.
Okay. When we made the film, March, with the people from Cannes, the agents from Cannes, they come to America, they go to other places to solicit the films that they want to be in their festival. They saw Sidewalk Stories, it was 3/4 cut. We used a scratch track kind of with some classical music, some Scott Joplin. We didn't have a score at the time. They liked very much what they saw. They said, you know, Mr. Lane, I like to be called Mr. Lane. Mr. Lane, I'm playing. We liked the film, but it's too bad that it cannot be, for our festival. I said, wait, what does that mean? You like the film? I said, no, because it's not, it's not finished. And I said, wait, you mean if I finished the film, if I edited it, it would be a part of the Cannes Film Festival? I said, well, yes, we would love to have it, but there's no way you can finish it. I said, I can finish it. Leave that to me. I can finish it. No. You'd be crazy. You'd be crazy by the time. No. So I kind of had a verbal deal. If I finished the film, it would be in the Cannes Festival, as I said. When I was a little baby, right out of the womb, I was thinking, Cannes Festival, someday, right? So it was like a big thing. Now, my ex-lawyer, financier, the guy who put money in out of his pocket to make the movie, was delighted. You know, he didn't know much about film. He believed in me, believed in the project, believed in his money. He recognized that Cannes Film Festival is cool. If Charlie blows this, then we're screwed up. I told him that we can finish it, and Mark Marta, the composer, has to do the score. It's the dialogue of the film. There's no two ways about it. Mark is in Paris. I'm in New York. Howard Brickner, my executive producer, financier, said, you doing the score with Mark and him being in Paris and all, that may hold us up. That may screw us up. We have to get another composer. And I was like, say what? And that was like devastating for me because, again, like I said, Mark and I, we have the shorthand, boom, boom, boom. He was already composing themes from my unfinished film. And all of a sudden, I get overruled that we're going to get another composer. Now, what does that mean for a silent movie where the music is specifically dialogue and everything? Another composer, I don't know what that means. But I was overruled. So we got his wife's boss's daughter's husband to write the score, right? Circuitous, right? And who is this guy? And may he rest in peace. But who is this clown? You know, it makes no sense. So I had to do the best that I could do to try to do a score. So he wrote a score. I was, you know, holding his hand with it, and you know, again, like what I was doing with Mark in the beginning. But Mark is now Frankenstein. You know, he can't. There's nothing Mark Marta can't do with a score. But this guy. Okay, but he was there, he was available, but it was a nightmare, and he also did it on the synthesizer, so there were no real voices, like here, you have all the colors, you know, we got 33 pieces of orchestra playing here, and so he had to synthesize the electronic stuff, and that was Sidewalk Stories, and so at most, at very most, that score was serviceable, but it was not terribly good. And so when we went into competition at the Cannes Film Festival, we were in the director's fortnight, and so the prize there was the camera door, the golden camera, and $50,000. And Whoopi Goldberg was the president of the jury at that time. And what happened was we had a split with the jury. Part of the jury said Cyborg Stories, hands down, is the best film in this category and should win. The other half of the jury said, not so fast, comrade, the score sucks. And, you know, so they went back and forth with the argument about, well, look, the score sucks, but you see what the young man is doing. I was young in those days. You see what the young man is doing here. Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but what he's doing is he has a fucking bad score, and you can't separate the two, and that's part of the movie. As a matter of fact, it's the dialogue of the movie. And so they went back and forth again, and I lost out on it. So Sidewalk didn't win that prize. It won another prize in Cannes called the...
The Prix du Public.
Yeah, the Public Prize. But lost out on the Camera d'Or. And... then it was time to negotiate to see who would distribute the film commercially, and we had a couple of companies, Circle being one, Miramax marginally, and Island Pictures aggressively. So Chris Blackwell was the CEO. Island Pictures is a subsidiary of Island Records.
And they released She's Gotta Have It.
She's Gotta Have It, and Stranger Than Paradise, Jim Jarmusch's film. And they also released, you know, musically, Bob Marley was there with the label and so on. So they were very interested in Sidewalk. And my proviso was, when you buy the film, can we get the score the way it was supposed to be with Mark Mortar and Chris Blackwell, of course. Island Pictures is about music. And they said, well, we have many composers, Mr. Lane, you know, Charles, we have many composers, you know? And I said, yeah, but Mark is the guy. I said, yeah, well, let me interview, let me see, because really we have many people who can write music, and you won't be sorry. I said, yeah, I think I'll be sorry. I was sorry the first time, I think I'll be sorry now. So he interviewed Mark, and Mark and I had like a session of, you know, Mark, what big musical terms do you know? And he said, well, Mark is such a modest guy, right? And he said, well, I mean, there are many terms, Charlie, but what are you after? I said, well, you got to impress Chris Blackwell. Like the first part of the music that you have in mind, what are you thinking? He said, well, you know, I think it should be a polyrhythmic. Polyrhythmic, that's good. Make sure you say polyrhythmic to him, because I didn't know what it meant. He said, yeah, polyrhythmic thing. And so we, you know, we got a little script from Mark. He talked to Chris. Chris called to me the next day and says, your guy is good. He knows what he's doing. He's hired. And I said, great. So then Mark is in Paris. I'm in New York. We do the score. Not much money to do it. Cecilia can probably testify to that. Not much money to do it, but we did it. And, and I remember Ann Stein, my co-editor, she, some of the words she had for that first score, I can't even say here, and I like to curse, but she really didn't like the score. And then when she heard Mark's stuff, she's like, she was like in heaven, like, this is the way it should be, you know. She's a lady of great taste, and she understood this is the music. It was day and night for her and for me. And then that's the Sidewalk Stories that we see now.
Well, I think we learned two things tonight, Charles, is to always stick by your guns and torture your children to make a fine movie. Ladies and gentlemen, let's thank for the 25th anniversary, the creator of Sidewalk Stories, Mr. Lane, Charles Lane.
That was filmmaker Charles Lane, the creator of Sidewalk Stories, in conversation with Elvis Mitchell as part of Film Independent at LACMA. Thanks to Film Independent for letting us record the interview. The treatment is edited and produced by me, Jenny Radelet. It's mixed by Melissa Morton. You can find us on Facebook by searching for KCRW The Treatment. For more screenings from Film Independent at LACMA, visit filmindependent.org/LACMA.